part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
In a darkened room in Campbell Hall, the WILL Pledge Team begins planning the October Fund Drive.
Hey, who took the last jelly donut?
Okay, everyone. It's time to plan our October Pledge Drive.
So how many days? I say we do the usual 8. What do you say?
Let's try something different.
Like?
Let's make it shorter.
We still have to raise enough to pay for the programs. I want people to have the services they expect from us.
It'll work. We can ask people to help by mailing a gift before the drive begins.
Hey, the website, willpledge.org. We can ask people to pledge early online.
I know. We can build a member match fund, then use it on air to encourage other listeners to make their pledges.
I like it. You guys work out the details. Now, where's that donut box?
Stay tuned for further details on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Longfellow called it the organ of the soul. It is the human voice. Journalist and sociologist Ann Karpf says it is the most important sound in our lives. Yet, she says, we pay it little attention. She says as we become speakers of language, our attention turns to words. This afternoon, we're going to pay some attention to the voice. Ann Karpf is our guest. She has done a good deal of thinking and research on the topic of the voice. She is the author of The Human Voice, How This Extraordinary Instrument Reveals Essential Clues About Who We Are. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ann Karpf is a broadcaster with the BBC. She writes a weekly column on the family for The Guardian. In addition to The Human Voice, she is the author of The War After and Doctoring the Media. Her new book, The Human Voice, How This Extraordinary Instrument Reveals Essential Clues About Who We Are, is published by Bloomsbury. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ann Karpf, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. The pleasure's mine.
As you note, early in the book, most of us pay attention to the voice only when it goes wrong. Why do we take the voice, this so important sound in our lives?
Well, I think part of the problem is that people often say we are a visual society, that we are more interested in the image than sound. And certainly, I think that has begun to change. And in the last decade or so, there's been a lot of attention paid to conversation, to language, to how people communicate and miscommunicate. But still, that has tended to focus on words and on spoken language, not necessarily written language, but spoken language, and has tended to ignore the channel through which those words get communicated. So I think, there's a lot of prejudice around, and there is a belief that somehow the oral belongs to something quite primitive, that we're so sophisticated that we've now advanced beyond that. What I argue in the book is that actually it's at the heart of all human communication, and adds something so irreplaceable, which you see when you see how one struggles to convey nuance in email, for example, when you lack those subtle tones that you can communicate through the voice.
Yeah, you can get into a lot of trouble with email. We do speak, though, of finding one's voice, of having a voice. We also speak of thinking out loud. From time to time, we may say or we may think, yeah, I hear you. Doesn't that indicate that we do have a good deal of appreciation of the import of the voice.
Yes, I think we have an instinctive understanding of how important this is, and I think most of us use it every day in interpreting and understanding those who are close to us, the people we work with. The problem, I think, is that we don't have a shared language with which to describe it. We're very impoverished when it comes to ways of describing the voice or audio compared with our vocabulary around the visual. And I give the example of a Mexican tribe who speak a language called Tzeltal. Now, this group of people have over 400 different words to describe all kinds of vocal states. And they've got such a rich vocabulary. It's phenomenal. They can describe particular states of voice. They can even describe someone's voice when they say, and I always think my husband would love this one, when they say, I'm going, but they don't really mean it. Now, how fabulous to have terms that would convey, you know, exactly what's in the voice when you're communicating that. So I think it is possible. We know it's possible, and we know that in pre-literate societies where everything was conducted through the voice, there was a much more heightened awareness of what it could do. So I think it's partly that, you know, it's partly the propaganda of a culture that says it's visual. But I challenge that in my book, and I say, no, we are still very much an oral society, and we will be as long as they're human beings.
Yeah. You report that people who develop a richer understanding of the voice are less likely to mishear friends, lovers, rivals, and are more able to know when people are being authentic or dishonest.
Yes, it's a large claim, and I probably contradict it at several points in the book because I don't actually hold with the view that we have a single authentic voice. I think, you know, and I'm sure most of your listeners will know this from their own experience, that we all of us have many different voices, depending on who we're speaking to, how well we know them, the situation, whether it's a formal or informal one, even the time of day. I mean, one study found that men's voices, much more than women's, fluctuated throughout the day. It didn't link this to alcohol, I have to say, and even throughout the year. So there's been some very interesting work on what's called convergence, which is that phenomenon of when you're talking to somebody, your voice changes to become more like theirs. I mean, a lot of studies have found that we converge, we begin to almost imitate a person we're talking to if they're more powerful than us. And one study looked at the Larry King show in the States and found that Larry King's voice adapted to the people he was talking to if they were presidents or ex-presidents or A-list celebrities. If, however, they were unimportant politicians or B-list celebrities, then they adapted their voice to his. So we're changing our voices the whole time. So I don't think there is a single authentic voice. We have a range of voices that are more authentic and less authentic. Mm-hmm. And I think it depends partly on how well you know someone. But if you attend to the voice, it can reveal an enormous amount. I mean, there was one, I think, rather fascinating study that was conducted. Well, first of all, there have been studies that found that people can tell how many years of schooling someone has had just from their voice. But a Canadian study found that listeners who spoke no French at all could listen to French Canadians and tell quite accurately what their social class was just from their voice alone. So in other words, they knew nothing of the language. So there's an enormous amount that we're picking up all the time from the voice. So in a way, my book is just an attempt to make this a little bit more conscious and a little bit more shared.
Yeah. Talk with us about the idea of class and how that comes through in people's voices. And I would suspect that while it's important in the U.S., it's even more important in Britain.
Well, people always say that and think of Britain as a very kind of class-dominated society, which it is. But I think it's probably an international thing. It may not be classes is a bit slightly harder to discern, I think, in the United States. You might think of it more easily if you think about prejudice against Southern accents, for example, and the idea that certain groups of people are less intelligent than others. But I think it's not just a question of accent. I think it's something to do with feeling entitled. I think there's a sense of entitlement that comes through people's voices, a sense of confidence, of social confidence, of being able to lay claim to the air, almost, that emerges through someone's voice and that comes from growing up in a more privileged environment and having had an education that gives you high expectations. And I think these feelings do emerge in people's voices, so that you can tell an enormous amount just on that level.
Mm. In the book, you write about the public voice. You devote a chapter to the public voice. And if you would you offer us your thoughts about the role of voice in our elections here in the U.S. 2000-2004?
Well, I think the voice played a very important part. I mean, it is interesting because if you go back to ancient Greece, where oratory was born, I mean, they had an enormous understanding, very rich, detailed understanding of how important the voice was in the art of persuasion. And I think it kind of got a bit lost in some ways in terms of the political realm. I mean, it didn't get lost, but I would say, perhaps more accurately, it got changed with the arrival of electronic mass communications and with FDR and the fireside chats. I mean, there you had a kind of a politician who knew in a kind of consummate way how to use radio. I mean, he spoke much slower than most people did. He brought enormous gravitas and reassurance to his voice, and it became a kind of symbol of safety for people listening to FDR. And over the years, politicians who can use radio and then television effectively are at an enormous advantage. I mean, think of someone like Ronald Reagan, or even someone like Bill Clinton, who actually had very often a rather damaged voice. His voice was often very hoarse, but he could use it so well to convey warmth, to, you know, his, you know, I feel your pain kind of voice, which was also a rather sexy voice, I thought, did very well. Now, when you come to people like Al Gore and John Kerry, who have these kind of very stiff, monotonous voices, and who don't manage to suggest the kind of intimacy which is almost obligatory, I would say, now from a modern politician. A modern politician, particularly in the United States, but almost equally, I would say, in the UK, has to suggest that he's the kind of chap who you want to have around for a barbecue. And, you know, is at ease with himself in the world, is genial, which, of course, George W. Bush does very effectively. And Al Gore and John Kerry just couldn't do that. And I think it probably did tell against them. I mean, I'm not saying they lost the elections because of their voices, but I think that was a sort of symbol of how they couldn't really do that chatty, intimate thing, which is required of politicians now.
Mm. I'm wondering if today, as we're talking September 7th, 2006, if you heard the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, his statement today.
Yes.
And how you heard his voice today.
Well, Tony Blair's got a real problem with his voice, I think. And if you go back to 1997, when Princess Diana died, he made a very famous speech in which he talked about the people's princess, and his voice broke. There was a kind of register break there. He was so overwhelmed by emotion. He had a good relationship with her. And it was a very powerful speech. It was felt in this country that he spoke much more in a much more impassioned way than any member of the royal family, and it almost provoked a constitutional crisis. Now, the problem is that since then, Tony Blair has used almost exactly the same voice absolutely endlessly. And, you know, he can be talking about sewage, he can be talking about education, he can be talking about Iraq. He speaks in exactly the same way. And people have become very suspicious of him. They feel like, how can anyone be so carried away by emotion on so many different topics? And the late Arthur Miller, the playwright, said that every politician nowadays had to be an actor. And I think the problem with Tony Blair is that you can feel him acting. I mean, I'm not denying that when Princess Diana died, he was deeply affected. He probably is on a number of things he talks about. But the feeling is that you can't be that emotional so often about so many different things. So this, you know, lots of pauses in his voice, sounding as if he's really can barely contain his tears, you know, even when he's talking about some prosaic little bill in the House of Commons, it does make people doubt him. And I think there's been a real backlash to him, obviously for lots of reasons, not least his policies. But also I think the way he sounds has been a part of that, because it makes people feel that it's all spin, that it's all the art of self-presentation, and that there's no substance to it. That he's become a sort of, in a way, an emblem of a sort of makeover culture where everything is about appearance and there's no substance. And I think his voice has played a part in that.
Hmm. Today, to my ear, he sounded a little whipped.
Yes.
As well.
I think you heard very correctly. I think he was embarrassed a bit. Yeah. I heard some embarrassment there. I mean, he's clearly been in a very difficult position for all sorts of reasons, and he couldn't say too much. But one felt today that the feeling were very authentic, and he didn't have to manufacture anything because it was all there. The problem is, you know, as I said, when he's not talking about such momentous issues, but still has the same kind of voice that he did today. And, you know, it's as if his voice has kind of cried wolf too often.
Hmm. Ann Karpf is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of The Human Voice, How This Extraordinary Instrument Reveals Essential Clues About Who We Are. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now on the toll-free line, calling us from Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Could I ask two questions, please?
Sure.
Is there any research, or do you have any opinion about whether speaking in a lower range, a lower register, makes one a bit more authoritative, or it's better to speak in that range when that comes across to other people?
Well, that is a very, very interesting question, to which I devote quite a lot of space in my book, because traditionally, of course, men have spoken in a deeper voice than women, although to what extent this is anatomical and physiological and to what extent it's social and cultural is really an open question, because we know that boys begin to speak differently from girls quite a time before there's any anatomical difference between them, which suggests that this is a kind of learned thing. And also there are differences between cultures in how deep men speak and how high women speak. However, that said, an interesting Australian study found that women's voices had deepened quite significantly over the past 40 years. And I think one of the reasons, again, there may be physiological reasons, women may be larger, for example, but I think one reason probably is that more women have entered the workforce, and the deeper voice is associated with authority and gravitas and making people listen. And the little announcements in a very high-pitched voice, how would you feel? And I suspect that a lot of us, even though we don't think of ourselves as prejudiced, would think, oh, my goodness. So I think that, I mean, this is what makes the voice such a fascinating subject. Whereas it is a very revealing instrument, we also have a lot of stereotypes that are attached to voice, and we make judgments that are often quite inaccurate on the basis of voice. For example, we think a lot of studies have shown that people who speak faster are considered more knowledgeable and more educated. Whereas, of course, it may in fact be that a person who speaks slower is being more thoughtful. So, I mean, you know, speaking deeper can sound more authoritative, but then there's the awful lesson of Margaret Thatcher, whose voice deepened so much that she interfered with the natural cues that tell another person when they can interrupt. And so she was interrupted a lot more than a lot of other politicians. So I think that if you artificially try and make your voice a lot deeper than it wants to go, what you can, you're at risk of deadening your voice. And one of the things that makes a voice nice, no matter if it's high or low, is if it has energy in it, if it's an alive thing. So I'm sorry, I've given you a very long answer to your question, but it's a very interesting one.
The second question is, could you just give some signs or indications of an authentic voice, or maybe just marks?
Well, now, you see, that is what's so interesting, because one can't, because it just depends on an individual. And what it depends on, I think, is getting to know an individual voice well, so you can then tell when that voice is markedly different from that. I mean, there's not the equivalent, alas, of Pinocchio's nose of the voice. You know, in other words, doing this person must be lying because they are hesitating, or because they are, you know, I mean, there are lots of manuals that have tried to sort of draw up, you know, things to watch for in that way, and no one has succeeded, otherwise they'd be extremely rich, I can tell you, and I would have tried it too. But what it is if you know someone very well, and you know what they normally sound like in a particular situation, if in that situation they sound different, then that's the thing to watch for. I mean, with my sister and I, we have a thing where, you know, I'll phone her and I'll say, hello, and she'll say, what's the matter? Because she knows my voice so well. She also happens to be a voiceover actress, so she's very attuned to the voice. You know, with my husband and me, you know, I can tell when he doesn't quite mean what he wants. And I interviewed a couple for the book. He is American, she's British. And she said she always knows when she asks him to do something, if he says, yeah, okay, that's fine. She says he's got about a dozen different that's fines, and she knows which one will mean that he'll give her a hard time a week later saying, you know, I never wanted to do that. So I think it's about the intimacy that you develop with somebody, or familiarity, and if not intimacy, familiarity, and then hearing when something is different and developing the means of interpreting that. So I'm sorry I can't give you some instant code by which you can discover if people are lying to you, but I don't think such a thing exists.
Could I make one more comment, please?
Certainly.
It seems like one can detect sarcasm and anger in a voice quite maybe more readily than anything else. Maybe the last couple things you were talking about would be an example of that.
I think you've really hit the nail on the head with sarcasm. I mean, I think sarcasm is a particularly interesting one, because as one person said, it's a way of saying something and not taking responsibility for it, because sometimes, you know, because obviously the words are usually saying the complete opposite of what they appear to be, just because of the tone of voice. So sarcasm is a very, very interesting one. And I know that in certain boot camps in the United States, there's a no sarcasm rule. And in Britain, somebody was given an ASBO, which is an antisocial sort of protection order, limiting what they can do and say because they've been behaving in an antisocial way. And one of them was they weren't allowed to use sarcasm. So I think that's one of the, sarcasm has become a social crime almost. But I agree with you. I think sarcasm, anger usually, but then of course there are different kinds of anger. I mean, there's hot anger and there's cool anger. So again, I think we need lots of kind of gradations of of anger. But I think you're right. It's certainly true that some emotions are much easier to hear in the voice than others. And of course, some people's voices are more expressive than others, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The human voice, our topic this afternoon here on the program. Our guest is Ann Karp, author of The Human Voice, How This Extraordinary Instrument Reveals Essential Clues About Who We Are. Would you recommend that we work to become better at hearing, at listening to our own voices? And I suspect the answer is yes. And then how could we go about doing that?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things I read suggested that with small children, you can play the banana game, which is where you say banana, or you can say breakfast cereal, or anything you want. You just take one word, and, I mean, children love doing this anyway. They often do it instinctively. And you say that word in lots of different ways with lots of different emotions. And so you get your child. I mean, I'm very hesitant of recommending this, because I think the list of what parents, particularly mothers, are supposed to do with their children grows so much larger each day that you need a lifetime just to get through it all. And there's so many more things to feel guilty about not doing. I don't want to add to it. However, having said that, it is quite a good thing to do, because I think some of the other interesting research, again, I'm a little bit skeptical about some of it, but it does seem to show that children who have difficulty decoding emotion that's expressed through the voice can get into a lot of trouble quite early on, and they are less popular with their peer group even while they're still in nursery or in daycare, even before they've started school. So that this tells us that the ability to read emotion in the voice and pick up quite subtle cues and nuances is an extremely important part of our interpersonal communication. And if we don't have it very well developed, we can suffer socially and later on professionally and in every sense. Now, I think obviously part of it is if you have, if you are in a vaguely emotionally literate environment where this instrument is used with a degree of skill, you're likely to pick that up. But I think you can encourage it by focusing attention, or by saying, what was that you meant? Because you said this, but actually your voice was telling me something completely different. And getting children, I mean, I think children are so focused on the audio, and particularly pre-verbal children, but even in the early stages of verbal, it's like they belong in both these cultures. So encouraging them, showing them that this is a valuable skill. I think sometimes we are so pressurized and keen for our children to use words, and I plead guilty here, that we don't encourage them enough, or, you know, reward them or enthuse enough when they show other kinds of intelligence, like a kind of audio intelligence. So I think that that is something we can do individually, and obviously I would like to see that happen more collectively in schools and generally socially. But I think it's remarkable what children can pick up. They're very, very skilled in body language and nonverbal communication.
And if you tell them a story, and if you almost act it out, if you're really involved in that story, all the better.
They love it. My younger daughter always used to say, still does, do the voices. She loved that more than anything else. And now she's a fantastic reader herself. Very, very late reader, incidentally. This is one of my other hobby horses. We let her, you know, we didn't put pressure on her to read. She started only reading really fluently when she was almost 7. And she's now 10, and she's a fantastic reader, and a fantastic reader aloud, and takes such pleasure from doing the voices. So I think, you know, the more that that's encouraged. And it is interesting, because when kids get older, and indeed among adults, if you see someone moving their lips when they read, or even reading aloud, there's a tremendous prejudice against it. It's almost become a sign of stupidity, whereas I think it's a sign of somebody really enjoying reading on lots of different levels, on a kind of audio level as well as just on the printed page. So I think, you know, both my children love reading aloud, even now, and they like reading aloud to me. Even the older one is a lot taller than I am. And I think that should be encouraged. You know, every way of valuing the oral, I think, is, you know, is terrific.
Yeah. I know a radio reporter who, when she is working, when she's writing her story, it's as if she is speaking it, and her whole body is involved, and she's having such a wonderful time doing it. So there you have it at the grown-up level, you know, too, as well. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi, is that me?
That's you.
Okay. This is a fascinating discussion, and I really look forward to reading your book. I wanted to make a comment concerning the training of dogs. and the extent to which the voice is extremely critical in how you communicate. The dog doesn't understand the dog typically doesn't understand the words at all, but it sure does understand the whole intonation, all the other things that go together with the voice. And there are people who simply cannot get their dogs to do certain things because of the way they use their voice. They simply do not have the commanding or the intonation or whatever it is that the voice is carrying that will make the dog pay attention to it. So I think the what you're talking about in terms of voice is also terribly important in terms of communicating with other creatures that don't share a language with us.
I think that is a really, really interesting point. I'm certain you're right, and it is interesting because the research that's been done on what's been called mother talk or parent ease, you know, how parents, particularly mothers, it's been found, communicate with small babies, has found that way of talking, you know, very kind of swooping, arching, you know, hello, darling, all that sort of thing, and stretching the vowels, is very similar to how people communicate with pets. And both of them are a way of expressing affection, among other things. But I think what you've pinpointed that is particularly interesting is how one can say something and sound like one means it. And I don't have much experience with pets, but I do have. I did observe a woman whose son was running rather dangerously, her 7-year-old son, down a rather steep hill. And she called out, "Don't do that, darling," in such a way that it sounded completely as if she expected not to be obeyed. And, of course, she wasn't. And it made me think quite a lot about how when you say something to children, and I'm sure the same must be true to a pet, that you really mean, and where you're suggesting with your voice that if they don't, you know, that what, you know, you cannot disagree with this, it brooks no disagreement, it's picked up. And the opposite is true, that when, and this is often rather weak, ineffective parents, of which we're all like that some of the time. I don't think that's just a category. I think it's, you know, a state that all of us fall into sometime or other. When one says something without much conviction, then that's heard as well. And I'm sure you're right that particularly with creatures that don't use words, they must be even more sensitive to the sound. So I think that's a very interesting point.
Have you seen any research on this, the voice in communicating with animals?
Yes, there are a number of interesting papers about communicating the voice and pets. One of them has the wonderful title of doggerel, but a nice pun. But yes, there are. It is a sort of emerging field, actually, the voice and pets, and it sounds kind of funny because, you know, it sounds like a rather esoteric subject to study, but I think it's a very interesting one. I think it, first of all, it can throw light on communication between humans as well, but I think also just, you know, it's a very interesting one about how we use our voice in communicating with other species and the sounds animals make in themselves, but also how they respond to the human voice. It's a fascinating subject.
Well, I want to thank you for the call. Some months back, my husband and I adopted a cat, a 5-year-old cat, from the shelter. And when we brought him home, he hardly meowed. He would open his mouth as if to meow, but it would be a silent meow. And then after a number of weeks went by, he began to find his voice. And now he's quite a meower.
Wow. How amazing.
Isn't that something?
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Next, we're going to go to Paris, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. I had the joy and the terror of studying under Severina Nelson at the University of Illinois in grad school, who taught the art of interpretation and also founded the School of Speech Pathology there at the university back in the 30s, and this was in the late 50s when I studied with her. And after looking at a lot of larynxes and such and bottles and such and learning the anatomy of the voice, then she taught us how to expand the voice and how to place the voice and utilize our vocal folds in order to be able to express ourselves in poetry or in, you know, regular literature, so that we could interpret the voice of the writer. And I think that expanded my understanding. Also, I was reading, because your program had been, you know, pre-announced this morning about who was going to be on, and so I went and read the review by Marek Cohen in The Independent, and she mentioned something, or he, I don't know who is Marek.
He, yes.
A male or female?
Yes, a male, yeah.
Male, all right. Spoke about the fact that you didn't incorporate anything dealing with singing.
And yes. I explain in my, first of all, I should say you've got a very rich resonant voice, so I can tell you've done some exercising of it, because it's a powerful instrument, your own voice, if
Thank
I may
you.
Say so. I deliberately made a decision to not write about singing, although I say in my book that the singing voice and the speaking voice are essentially one and the same, partly because there's been an awful lot written on singing, and I just felt that I couldn't cope with both the singing and speaking voice in one volume. I just thought it would be too much material. I mean, I think it's fascinating. I think the singing voice is the most fascinating subject, and, you know, the effect of singing, what it does to you, just opening your body up, and the breath, and the way people use their voice in singing. It is an enormous and very rich subject, but I just felt that I had to limit myself to the speaking voice, partly because people don't know as much about it. They tend to think it's about accent or whatever. And in fact, quite a lot of people, when I said that I was writing this book, would stare at me blankly and say they'd never given the subject a moment's thought. And then almost instantly they began to regale me with stories about voices they liked and voices they didn't like. And it was quite clear that they had given it quite a lot of thought. Not perhaps thought, but they had quite strong feelings on the subject. So I felt that this was the bit that I was going to look at. But I mean, of course, the singing voice is a most marvelous subject for study.
Well, I find that in teaching voice, and primarily I deal with working with radio and TV people who are fresh out of college or university and have absolutely no comprehension about how to speak. You know, they get the ethics of radio and television, but somehow they miss the technique of performing in front of a camera or a microphone. And so I use the combination of singing and speaking in order to teach them how to perform, and that's the word to use, on TV. And they oftentimes come to me and say, well, I can't sing. And yet, by a few lessons, they have learned that they do have the control, and that's what singing is. It's developing the control.
Well, perhaps I should come to you, because I can't sing.
Well, I'd be happy to make an appointment with you. Are you in London?
I am, yes.
Well, I have a cousin in London, so maybe we can get together.
Okay. Look forward to it.
But I'm looking forward. I had not heard of your book being published rather recently.
Yes, just
I think it was the 22nd of
That's
August.
Right.
That's one publishing date I got, but anyway. I'm looking forward to reading it, and maybe we can correspond about
that. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to Chicago. Line 2, a listener in Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The reference earlier to animals reminded me of the logo on the RCA Victor recording of his master's voice. I believe that's the way to refer to it. Showed this picture of this dog listening to the large gramophone recording. And in a sense, master's voice reminded me of the leadership that countries have from time to time, and temporarily, and while they're in office, they're regarded as our masters. But as they speak, they do reveal certain strengths and sometimes carry a lot of momentum, and then the momentum runs down and it reflects in their position. I wonder if you could reflect on some of the leadership, perhaps in-person voices you've heard, such as Winston Churchill, and of course recently Tony Blair, you've commented on. Mm-hmm. And in this country we had the fortunate opportunity to hear Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our former president, to write through the others in between up to our current president. And they certainly reveal certain strengths and frailties. I'm reminded of another person, who Seymour Hersh, and others who have recorded the, and transcribed the phone conversations in the Oval Office of the White House, and in some off-guarded moments reveal certain qualities mm-hmm. in their voice, let alone the conversation. And it would be very rich to have had your interpretation mm-hmm. on those.
Well, I think the whole subject of the public voice and the politician's voice is a really fascinating one, because, you know, the last it's less than a century that really we are hearing the voices of politicians who in the past people would only see as photographs or distant figures or hear about. Now we can actually hear them, but still in a very public sense, in a rather kind of controlled way. And I think the politician's voice is, as I said before, really a very important tool. People like FDR and Winston Churchill really mobilized the courage of their people through their use of the voice through, at a time of crisis. So it was a very, very important instrument. The style of speaking nowadays has changed enormously, and television and radio have played a part in that, in that oratory is not admired in the same way, except at times of crisis. And as I was saying before, politicians are expected to be a bit more sort of matey and chatty and intimate now, rather than give this enormous sort of resonant address. So I think the style of political communication has changed a lot, and probably will continue to change. So that although you can tell something about an individual and how they're filling a role by the way they use their voice, you also can tell quite a lot about the period in which they're living and working. And I think that the voices of current politicians, you know, really reveal as much about us and what we expect from a politician as it does of the politicians themselves. I mean, I don't know that I can tell that much of George W. Bush. I mean, I suppose one of the things that I notice, and this is a foreigner's view, is that he uses a lot of pauses in when he speaks. Now, some people have said to me he's trying to think what to say next. I think it's probably trying to insert some gravitas into what he's saying, and it's what a lot of current politicians do. I mean, they pause. It's as if, you know, we can only take in a sound bite at a time rather than a sound at a time. So I think, I mean, politicians' voices are fascinating. Sorry?
I think he was telling us he had to run.
Okay.
That's very interesting. You know, I'm thinking about how we mature, how our voices mature, and how we find our voice, mm-hmm. back to that idea. I interviewed a fellow, very, very interesting man by the name of Jared Brown. He's a biographer, and he has done a lot of work writing biographies of people in the theater. His most recent book is about Moss Hart, and he tells a wonderful story in there about Julie Andrews trying to fill the role of Eliza Doolittle, going from Cockney to a woman of poise. And it was so difficult for her. She was all of 19 when she was on the stage in that role.
That's very interesting. And if you think of Audrey Hepburn doing it in the movie, I mean, again, Cockney, well, I mean, of course, the most famous bad Cockney of them all was Dick Van Dyke, whose Cockney is legendary, and I don't know if it's known in the States, but
Mary Poppins, yeah.
His Cockney is mocked every day, yeah, in this country. It's become a sort of byword for a bad accent. I mean, accents are very interesting, and the whole thing about the voice in acting and actually taking on someone else's voice is a very, very interesting challenge, I think, because most actors' voices are so distinctive that they almost always, you know, they tend to sound the same. And there's not, I mean, with the exception of people like Meryl Streep, there's not a huge amount of vocal variety around, I think, at the moment. You know, maybe we're just going through a phase where this isn't a quality that's very admired. But I tend to think that actors after a particular time sound always like, you know, I mean, much as I love him, Al Pacino does tend to, you know, sound like Al Pacino, and most actors do. So I think, I don't know whether this is to do with the way that voice is taught in drama schools nowadays, or what is wanted of the big star, that they should sound like the big star. But I think the amount of vocal versatility is pretty limited.
You use a term in the book that I think is very interesting, vocal culture. Here to sum up, would you like to offer an observation in general about our vocal culture today?
Well, I think it's a little bit impoverished in some ways, in that we, you know, I think it is changing. I think there's a growing interest in all things audio, but I think we have for a long time been persuaded by the propagandists of the eye, if you like, that ours is a culture of books and of images and not of sounds and voices. And I really want to challenge that, because I think that actually we have phenomenal vocal skills, all of us. I mean, from before we're born, where babies can distinguish not just between male and female voices, but even between the voices of their mother and other women. So we are born with phenomenal vocal skills, both in our understanding of other people's voices and in how we develop our own voices. And what we need, perhaps, is to celebrate this fact a little more, focus on it a bit more in education and in the culture in general. And the potential for using the voice is enormous, what we can get from it. And it's a very, very enriching thing. And one thing I should say is that I found that people who are interested in the voice are generally very interesting people. It just so happens that I think people who are interested in something as elusive of the voice are usually quite subtle, sensitive people. So, of course, that goes for all your listeners. Goes without saying.
That's right. Anybody who listens to radio is interested in the voice. Anne, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Anne Karpf, author of The Human Voice, How This Extraordinary Instrument Reveals Essential Clues About Who We Are. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Let's find out now what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Thursday afternoon, futures in the wheat pent managed a 2-cent gain today, a 449 high for the Nambri September contract, low at 442.5, third settlement price at $4.49.